The Rebel Capitalist Show, Episode 12. Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show. All right, everyone. I'm very excited to bring someone to the show that I've got a ton of respect for. Really a great guy. His name is Alex Saunders, and he is with Nuggets News. And the reason I'm so excited to have him here is because he's not only a macro guy, but he really loves gold, loves silver, and he knows a lot about cryptocurrencies. So, Alex, welcome to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Thanks so much for having me on, George. I really love watching your channel grow, so it's awesome to be here.
Now, I'm sure a lot of my listeners or viewers know exactly who you are, but for those who don't know your backstory, can you kind of give us the Reader's Digest version of that?
Sure thing. So I was a pharmacist by trade, and I had a bit of a hobby interest in investing and lost a lot of money in the GFC like so many people. And I wanted to know how that all works and how someone can lose half your money and not see that coming, I guess. So yeah, that led me down the investing rabbit hole, and I loved science and numbers growing up. So I learned all about options, and then you go down the rabbit hole of banks, debt and money. So I became a bit of a gold and silver bug after that. And then in 2012, I read about Bitcoin, and I just thought, wow, this is going to take off. It's just a matter of time, digital money in a digital world. And then in 2017, as you know, I got a bit more mainstream adoption. So I quit everything else I was doing to focus on educating people full time around everything macro related, gold, silver, but particularly cryptocurrencies.
I'm very ignorant when it comes to the subject of cryptocurrency, although I really like it from a philosophical standpoint. I just haven't taken the time to really go deep into it. So I'd like to start by asking you some questions that are based on my limited knowledge of Bitcoin. And the way I've read about it, or the way I've looked at it in the past, in its current iteration, it would be difficult for it to be the world reserve currency because it's rather cumbersome. If it's doing, let's say, 1 billion transactions per minute. Yes. So in its current iteration, it seems like it would more be like a digital gold where you weren't just transacting with it on a daily basis, but it was kind of a store of value, where I see it a little more as a speculation. We can get into that later. But am I seeing it correctly, or is there something there that I'm just not seeing?
I think one of the reasons that Bitcoin is so difficult to understand is because it brings so many concepts together. And someone like yourself and your audience probably have a greater appreciation for what is money. So you're going to grasp these concepts better than most. But one of my favorite articles was about the platypus. And when that was first discovered, the people were saying, you know, what is this animal? It's got, you know, it's poisonous. It's a mammal. It lays eggs. It's got a beak. It just doesn't fit into any of these categories. And that's very much how I view Bitcoin. So to begin with, the white paper said peer-to-peer electronic cash, as you say. And that's what he was setting out to create, a method for people to pay each other. No matter where you and I are around the world, we can send each other money. And that was the light bulb moment for me, because we live in this digital world where you and I are sitting here having a high definition video chat. But if I want to send you money, it's going to take days and days. If we're in different countries, you're going to get scalped on the exchange rate, and you're going to pay an international transfer fee. And that basically makes small transactions impossible. So that's what Bitcoin set out to do. And as it became more and more popular, the network became congested. So it's a bit like the internet in the early days, where Bitcoin's only at dial-up speed at the moment. So when we have this mania of thousands of new people jumping on board, the bandwidth gets full, it gets clogged up. One of the solutions that some people have proposed is we should just make those pipes bigger and increase the amount of information we can fit in each block in the blockchain. But the trade-off there is that less people can run the network and run a node, as we call it. And the biggest attribute of Bitcoin is its decentralization, where everyone around the world can download a copy of the blockchain and support the network. Now, if you start making that a lot bigger, people have got to buy bigger hard drives, they've got to have better computers, they need better internet speeds. And so in a perfect world, we want Bitcoin as lightweight as possible, so people can run this on their phones in developing nations all around the world, and that keeps it as decentralized as possible, and that creates all its best attributes like censorship resistance and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So what are the holdups, or what are the barriers in front of Bitcoin right now that would keep it from being a transactional digital currency?
So as you said, it's kind of gone down this path of digital gold. And I think when people invent something, sometimes you don't know what you invented that it was going to have a better application. And at the moment, I guess the market is deciding that, hey, in this world of negative interest rates and money printing, maybe this currency that is limited and finite in supply, that is acting a bit like a digital gold in that respect, maybe that's what the world needs. And a lot of people are fleeing to the safety of that currency they know isn't going to be devalued. That's why it's so popular in Venezuela, Zimbabwe, you know, Chile, now Hong Kong. One by one, this list keeps growing of countries that are being irresponsible with their monetary policy. And if your audience understands gold, that's why there's a lot of similarities there. But as you say, if we want to make this a payment system, there's a few things that are being worked on. So there's a layer on top of Bitcoin called the Lightning Network that you've probably heard of. And that is, as it sounds, it's just taking your Bitcoin into a second layer where we can send each other payments more instantly and a lot lower cost as well. But there are trade-offs. We can't do as large a transactions with that just yet. The other things that all the developers are working on are making it as efficient as possible. So ideally, we don't have to make the block size or that bandwidth any bigger. We can just keep making it more and more efficient. So each transaction is getting smaller and smaller by using the latest computing techniques. You can think of that as. So in a perfect world, we don't have to make any changes or trade-offs to the decentralization and the actual network as it is, but it'll just get far more efficient. Just like internet routing these days, it, you know, pings all these messages around pretty much instantly. It's very efficient and you don't know anything that's happening on the back end. That's where we want Bitcoin to get to.
Okay, so in future iterations, it could be realistic for Bitcoin to be actual digital cash instead of just digital gold.
Yeah, and at the moment, that's why we've seen, I guess, some other cryptocurrencies catch on, definitely because Bitcoin did get slow and expensive at one stage there. So that's why you've got Bitcoin Cash. They forked away the network, which basically means they start their own copy and they say, look, we think we're going to increase that block size that I spoke about, and we think that that is the better trade-off. And this is the beautiful thing about a free market. People can experiment, and whatever is better is going to be the winner. So now we've got a number of cryptocurrencies, and I should probably preface that by saying that 99% of these are no good. They're either scams or they're not going to survive. But these days there's about 10,000 out there. So I really think there's between, you know, 50 or 100 really interesting projects that are now not trying to be digital money or gold. There's a wide range of applications of that blockchain technology for things that would be better off decentralized rather than in the hands, the power of a few. So, you know, Facebook, Google's, all these corporations, and banking's just one example of, hey, let's get rid of that power structure and let's give the power back to the people. And that's what blockchains are trying to do.
Right. Okay. So now that I'm kind of understanding how the pieces of the puzzle come together, I want to be a little selfish here. If I'm thinking about buying Bitcoin for myself, right now I see it as digital gold with a potential to be something even greater. But from a logistics standpoint, if I buy one Bitcoin and I've got that digitally stored on a thumb drive, and I go from the United States, I buy it in the US, and then I come to Australia. Now I'm living in Australia and I want to use that purchasing power. So how would I take it from a digital Bitcoin on my thumb drive to actual Australian dollars?
So there's a couple of options you've got. Each country has their own crypto exchanges where you sign up, you create an account and you can link a bank account. And just like you sell your shares, you know, you get that money deposited in your account. So you can just sell your Bitcoin on an exchange. The other options these days are cards. So I've got a number of crypto debit cards and they're just linked to my Bitcoin account. And I can just swipe those anywhere. You can use a credit card and it'll make that transaction for me. The company that issues the card, that will change the Bitcoin to Aussie dollars or US dollars, whatever country I'm in at the time of purchase. And the third option, which is what we ideally want in this utopia, is that there's a few hundred businesses now in Australia that just accept Bitcoin directly, the merchants. So you can just scan with your phone, send it with them on your computer if you're shopping online. Those methods are getting easier and easier, but they're basically the options.
Okay, but if the Bitcoin itself is just a group of number or a serial number, then it's got to live, for lack of a better term, on an app on your phone that you would swipe at the merchant terminal. So is there any counterparty risk to that?
So this concept is really important to understand. So Bitcoins themselves, they always live on the blockchain, on that database that everyone has a copy of around the world. So okay. The thing that lives on your thumb drive is actually your key, your password. And so if you go to send me $10 out of your $10,000, you just sign the transaction, a digital signature with your thumb drive that has your unique key on it. And then that tells the network, George wants to give Alex $10, or he wants to pay $5 for his coffee. Then it sends the change back to your address that live out there in cyberspace, but you've got the key. And that's why we hear these stories of hacks, because if you lose your thumb drive or you have your key on your computer and you leave it in your email inbox and someone at work reads it, as soon as someone else has that key, they have your Bitcoins. So Bitcoin itself has never been hacked. But if you leave your key laying around, then someone can get your Bitcoins.
Right. And the record of that transaction, you buying that coffee or whatever you're doing, that's always going to be permanently stored on the decentralized blockchain, the ledger, if you will, correct?
Absolutely. And everyone has a copy. Okay. So if you knock out the power, every power source around the world goes out. There's still going to be a few nodes running off, you know, solar setups in Outback Australia somewhere. As long as we've got one copy of that ledger, it can talk to all those nodes and reboot the network from scratch. We've got satellites in space now. It really is such a resilient system. And that's probably the third aspect that we haven't spoken about. So we've got a payment system, a digital gold, because it's so scarce and it can never be printed more of, like all the central banks around the world are doing. But yeah, we've got the most secure computer network ever. And what we saw last year was companies like Microsoft come out and say, well, we're going to build our new digital identification product on Bitcoin because it's so secure. It's better than anything we've got. And that is a massive statement, where these big tech giants are now building and piggybacking off Bitcoin.
Wow. That's so off of Bitcoin itself or the blockchain or both?
Yes. And Ethereum, which is the second largest one, which we might get into if you like later. But these big tech companies are using the public blockchains of Bitcoin, Ethereum, and a few others now as well.
Okay. So with your clients or the people that watch your channel, the podcast listeners, how, or in your personal life, how do you suggest looking at Bitcoin as it is right now from an investment standpoint?
So for you and I sitting in these developed countries, you know, we're fairly lucky. We don't have a crisis on our hands like in Venezuela or Zimbabwe. So for us, it is about a bit of speculation. And over time, Bitcoin has been the best performing asset nearly every year. I know it's volatile. It goes up and down a lot. But my belief is we are just capturing market share off gold, off Forex, off payment systems like PayPal and Stripe or Visa and MasterCard. So we're continually just capturing market share off all these other things, and that's why the market cap is growing. So at the moment, the market cap's around $100-200 billion, but that's really, you know, peanuts, can, you know, in terms of the stock market or Forex. And
it's like Tesla.
When you look around the world and these Southeast Asian countries, for example, they've all got market caps in the hundreds of billions of dollars. And all these people now have smartphones. And I just think that they're going to use Bitcoin, or they're going to turn to something that they know can't be printed. We live in this digital age where everyone's on WeChat in China and Alipay. So it's just a digital payment system. All governments are now talking about issuing their own cryptocurrencies. We can get into that, but that's a bit of a joke. It doesn't have any of the properties of what cryptocurrency set out to be. So you can either have a digital currency that's very limited, or you can have one that governments are going to abuse and censor and print more of. And that's why more people are choosing Bitcoin every day and the price goes up. But yes, it is volatile because it's a lot of speculation, a lot of trading and price discovery happening.
Yeah, and that's where I think the majority of my viewers, or at least the comments that I get, don't understand Bitcoin, or they see Bitcoin and gold as competitors. And I would disagree with that, because I see Bitcoin, or first and foremost, for everyone out there that doesn't watch my channel or might not be familiar with the stuff that I do, I like to compartmentalize my personal portfolio into investments, speculation, and insurance. For me, just by my definition, I say investments have to pay me to own them. Speculation, okay, that's where I'm betting on the price going up or down. And then insurance, I'm just maintaining my purchasing power. So I like to have a certain percentage, only 10% to insurance, 10% speculation, about 80% to investments. But I see Bitcoin, for me personally, just falling into that speculative category where I'm betting that the price will most likely go up because of all the reasons you just said. But then gold is more insurance, where I just know that 5,000 years ago, it could buy X amount of goods and services. And I'm quite confident that in another 500 years or another 5 years, it will also buy at least as much goods and services. So I don't really understand why, you know, if I get on Twitter or even in my comments, that the Bitcoin and the gold people just go back and forth and back and forth, when it seems to me like we're all on the same team. We're just looking at the asset. We're conflating the two asset classes as opposed to compartmentalizing them.
Absolutely. And it gets even worse once you get in the crypto community. They all bicker and fight and think each other's coins better. And you zoom out and we're just this tiny fraction of the financial world. But I'm a big advocate of gold and silver. You know, you can use those volatility arguments saying, well, silver went to $50 and down to 14. Does that mean it's not a great store of value over the long run? You know, not at all. So when we see the Iran situation unfold, that flight to safety, there's the trillions of dollars around the world in hedge funds that have got this low exposure to gold. Gold is still going to play such an important role when people want safety. But people that want a bit of something different, it's uncorrelated, it's new, it's the technology play, it's the payment system play. If you've got to move money from one country to another and you're in a, you know, suppressive regime, for example, you can't send it across this border for whatever reason, there's all these people that are using Bitcoin to help their lives for different reasons. And for them, it's not even an investment, as we say. But in the Western world, yeah, some people are saying, look, let's just have 1%. If it goes to zero, it doesn't matter. It's just such an asymmetric upside. And younger people are saying, I'm never going to be able to save enough for a house deposit here in Australia. You know, my best chance is probably putting my 5,000 into Bitcoin, and maybe in 5 years it'll turn into 25 or 50. So there's all these different reasons for people to speculate. But yeah, I'm still very bullish on the technology.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the key word there is asymmetry when you're looking at Bitcoin as a speculation. And that's why I've considered it in the past, because you figure, okay, let's say your downside is 75%. Okay, but what's your upside there? That it goes to a million? I mean, you know, if they were able to figure out that that payment component or that transaction component of it. So then you just have to say, okay, what's the probability of it going to X or the probability of it going to Y? And then based on what you think the math is, then it could make a lot of sense for that speculative purpose. But I think you touched on the government there, and that's one pushback that I always hear that makes a lot of sense to me. So what if the government comes in and they have their own digital currency? My buddy Eric Townsend with Macro Voices, he wrote an entire book on it, on government-backed digital currency. So obviously it's not a crypto, but it's a digital currency. He calls it the Orwell, and I think rightfully so, because to your earlier point, a government-backed digital currency would basically do the complete opposite of what Bitcoin intends to do. So how do you see government playing a role in the future of Bitcoin and cryptocurrency?
Yeah, it's completely 1984 George Orwell, as you say. So a lot of people are pretty familiar now with the fact that all our data and big tech is being used to surveil us, and Edward Snowden has spoken about that a lot. But once they can control our payment system, again, you can start to build a picture of where people were, what their spending habits are. They can on-sell that data. So it really is eroding more of our freedoms. So China have come out and said that they're launching theirs very soon. And again, they've already got the social credit system. So they'll be able to turn off your payment system. You know, if you jaywalk, you might not be able to buy food that night, this, that, or the other. Right. The ECB put out their white paper on Eurochain or Eurocoin last week. So these things are coming. And that's why it's so important to have the other opt-out system. So I think these government currencies will unfortunately probably be the way that we pay for things, particularly if they phase out cash.
I agree.
You will have to use them to pay for things, but there will be this other opt-out system where you can still have some degree of anonymity and whatnot. But it's more that store of value because at the end of the day, these government digital currencies are still just pegged to all the money printing and irresponsible behavior that is going to take place by central banks and governments.
Yeah, what if the government comes in and bans Bitcoin or says it's illegal to use Bitcoin? And to be clear, they've done that with gold, as we all know. So the gold buds can't say, well, that's why I don't like crypto, because the government can ban it, when we know that they can confiscate your gold as well. So
yes.
I'm not saying that either is good. Obviously, I really detest both of those thoughts, but it is possible on both ends of the scale. So is there a way that technology, or maybe it's a future iteration, can circumnavigate the potential of government coming in and saying, okay, now it's illegal to transact in Bitcoin? So although you have these Bitcoins, you could never really turn them into the Orwell, let's say, in order to actually buy things.
Mm. So that has happened in a few countries in practice. A lot of the time what we see is it actually creates a premium, like we see on the black market with illicit substances. So if you've got Bitcoin in Venezuela, it's trading for a premium once they make it illegal, or in India or whatnot. So what they can really control is the on-ramps, the exchanges, as you say, where you put money in or take money out. But there's always going to be a way to trade peer-to-peer. So trade someone for cash or for gold or for goods or services for Bitcoin if they accept Bitcoin directly, because it's a peer-to-peer transaction that the government can't surveil that transaction or stop that Bitcoin transaction. And the US Congress have actually acknowledged this when they had the hearings into the Facebook Libra currency. They were actually joking that Bitcoin doesn't have a CEO. We can't call anyone in here. We can't really stop this. If you think about what Bitcoin is, it's just ones and zeros. It's just a program that anyone can download that has the internet or a computer or a phone. You don't even need that. You can actually have a paper wallet with your key on there. So there's, unless you stop the internet, it's almost like stopping freedom of speech. You know, you can have your Bitcoin as 12 words that you can remember, and that'll turn into your Bitcoin. When you go to a computer in the next country, you can re-enter those 12 words that you've got memorized in your head. So there's all these ways around it. It's practically impossible for them to stop Bitcoin in any meaningful fashion.
Yeah, so that's a great point. I'm just trying to think this through out loud. If I was in Canada and they had a Canadian Orwell and I had Bitcoin, and if I just didn't like what was going on in Canada, correct me if I'm wrong, but I could just go over to Thailand where they don't have the government doesn't have the resources to control you as much, let's say, or XYZ country. And then I could get my Bitcoin or use my Bitcoin maybe in that other jurisdiction where they're not as draconian. And so in order for that to, and I understand there's a black market for it, so even if it's completely illegal and it's anonymous, so you could still technically transact back and forth if you're willing to take that risk. But if I'm hearing you right, the whole entire world would have to unite and say, we're not allowing Bitcoin, or it's illegal in the entire world, in order for you not to be able to find a place where you could transact. And let me take that a step further. I'm guessing that if that were to play out, especially in the major developed countries, the people that were, let's say, libertarian-minded, like you and I, and people who owned Bitcoin and were just fed up with the government, they would all probably migrate to this one place or these places that were much more Bitcoin-friendly. And is that the way you see things potentially playing out?
Yeah, so in Venezuela, we're seeing like really high rates. Like you've heard 50% reported of all transactions now take place in Bitcoin because their currency is just so poor and it's not accepted anywhere. Think about what happened in Greece, in Cyprus. You might remember back in 2013, That was when Bitcoin first ran from $100 to $1,000 because they shut down the ATMs, they shut down the bank accounts, they did the haircut where they bail in a percentage of your bank account. And at that point, even if Bitcoin's illegal, do you care if that's the only way you can feed your family or your only hope of fleeing the border? But as you say, you can go to another country, there's Bitcoin ATMs where you can get cash out. There's so many ways around it. And in this world of social media, I'm sure you remember Occupy Wall Street.
Sure.
People are familiar with these things. The day they make Bitcoin illegal, you and I are probably going to make a video and all the other YouTubers, all the libertarians, and we've got to put on yellow vests or we're going to protest or we're going to create Facebook groups and have some rallies. People aren't going to stand for their gold or their Bitcoin or things that they should be allowed to hold and they're not doing anyone any harm. If the government wants to make this poor choice to inflate away our currencies, why can't we choose what we invest in? And that's something that I think people will really stand up for.
That's really making a lot of sense. And you touched on negative interest rates a little bit earlier, and I wanted to expand on that. Generally, that's kind of the downside of gold, is that it's got a negative carry in the sense that you've got to store it and maybe do all these other things. But with negative interest rates, so they're stealing a portion of your cash every single year, or even negative yielding corporate debt or sovereign debt, it makes gold a lot more attractive. But then maybe you could expand on that and talk about Bitcoin, how one of the things that's beneficial is that there is no carrying cost to it. And again, I just, for all the people watching this, I'm not saying that Bitcoin is better than gold or gold is better than Bitcoin, because they're an apples to oranges comparison to them. I'm just trying to look at some of the variables there pertaining to negative interest rates.
Yeah, so last year we saw the amount of negative yielding debt get up to around $17 trillion. And because of what central banks have done, just this pattern of printing more money, we'll buy those bonds off you. People are now speculating just on the price of that bond going up. They don't care that they're losing money with a negative yield. So all of a sudden, if that ever stops, or if central banks ever stop buying these bonds, which I think is going to happen at some point, and we're going to get inflation at some point, everyone's going to run for the exits and there's not going to be enough buyers for those bonds. So that's probably a whole nother kettle of fish. But either way, rather than having a zero or negative yield, people joke that gold's a pet rock. Well, that's a beautiful pet rock when you're not paying negative and not losing money. So it's the same with Bitcoin. If you can hold your money in a world of negative interest rates all around you in gold or Bitcoin, then yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why we saw both move in tandem during that huge bout of negative yielding bonds in 2019.
Yeah, it is interesting that you see all the safety assets, or the flight to safety, really doing well in this time when supposedly the United States has the best economy of all time, right? According to Donald Trump's Twitter feed. All right. So we've really been focused on Bitcoin. A lot of the viewers, and I see in my comments all the time, people talking about Ripple. And I really don't even know where to begin with that. I haven't really read too much about that. Could you help me understand that? Maybe some of the pros and cons?
So as I said, these days there's a lot of different currencies that are trying to maybe disrupt different industries altogether. Now, Ripple is probably one of those ones that does have a financial flavor to it. And they've very openly from the start said that they're not trying to be as decentralized as Bitcoin. They want to build a new sort of payment system that replaces SWIFT, or those interbank lenders and all the remittance services. So that's their sort of target audience. Now, where it starts to get a bit topical is that there's a company, Ripple, and they still own the majority of those XRP tokens. And they're saying that they're going to distribute those as more payment providers come on board. So the argument is that Bitcoin say, no, you should be fully decentralized. And the Ripple community XRP holders say, well, Ripple's not fully centralized. It's not one company that's in control. We're just sort of bootstrapping until we get all these banks and everyone on board. But they're really trying to replace the rails of the financial system. So, yeah.
Is there a limited amount of XRP coins? And is it 21 million with Bitcoin?
21 million with Bitcoin. Ripple, I think, around 100 billion off the top of my head, and the company still owns 60 billion.
Okay, but how would you ensure that the company doesn't decide to print more Ripple coins?
So they've basically got a schedule where an unlock schedule where they can only release a certain amount of that 60 billion each month. Sometimes that goes back into escrow because they don't want to dilute holders. Everyone that's running the Ripple network and nodes would still have to agree to print more. So I'd say that it's basically impossible. You're going to upset a lot of the XRP investors if you ever did that. Whereas with Bitcoin, it's practically impossible because you're never going to get everyone agree to. So there's less players for the Ripple. But again, this is it's just such a divisive topic because some people are really anti the banks. Like a lot of the Bitcoin crowd was cypherpunks and libertarians that hate right. the banks. And then a few years later, Ripple come along and say, hey, we want to work with the banks. We want you using this cryptocurrency. So that's where I guess the friction starts between the two communities.
Oh, I can see why. Yeah. I can see why they think that that's that crypto group has gone to the dark side.
Yeah. I mean, the other one that I really like is Ethereum, and they're not really trying to be money as such or a payment system. They're trying to rebuild a decentralized internet from the ground up. So we're already seeing the world of decentralized finance being built on Ethereum, where you can get loans and we have these interest rates, bonds. It's mind blowing what is happening and there's no central party. So there's no Facebook or Google or YouTube to abuse your data, and there's no third parties involved. The new internet will all be built peer-to-peer where I can reward you as a content creator. You can, you know, sign up to my services and stream with micropayments, all these different applications. And they call them Legos because they're very easy to clip together and build one on top of another, all these different applications once the developers have built these certain standards. So they basically want to rebuild the internet from the ground up. And it's very exciting. It's one of my favorite projects.
Okay, so to understand Ethereum a little bit better, they have a token system as well. And I'm trying to think this through. So they've got a ledger for that token system, but how are they building an internet within that ecosystem?
So once again, we have, say, 10,000 computers around the world that all keep a copy of that ledger. And the problem they're facing is scaling, like we spoke about with Bitcoin as well, because obviously it's very hard to build these big applications at the moment when you need everyone to have a copy of everything. You know, you couldn't possibly expect every person to keep all of Facebook's data on their computer, for example.
Okay.
So they're, again, they're working on, well, what needs to be on that ledger? What can be on separate servers? How do we scale this network? How do we keep people's privacy? You know, they're starting at what's the most important things to rebuild the internet first, and then hopefully further down the line, we'll have a lot of these scaling solutions solved, and we'll see decentralized Facebooks. We've already got decentralized YouTubes and file storage. Yeah.
Yeah, it would seem to me that people a lot smarter than I am in Silicon Valley could really do the math on how long it would take to achieve these objectives, whether it's with Bitcoin or with Ethereum, based on Moore's law, can't they? Because I just remember, and I'm by no means a tech guy, but just using cell phones as an example and computers, I read something, and I'm going to butcher this, I'm sure, but something to the effect that the largest computer in the world 30 years ago had less memory than less capability than my iPhone has today. And that was based on math and Moore's law, if I'm not mistaken. So can't they use those same equations to figure out how fast they could free up these systems to allow them to do exactly what we want them to do?
It's slightly different. So in some ways, Moore's law has reached its limitations in a lot of what the hardware is doing these days. And probably the next big leap up is quantum computing, which is probably still a few years away. It's more the problem you're trying to solve is we can do all this already. how do we do it with a decentralized fashion where there's no company to shut down, there's no one in charge, everyone has a copy of that ledger, and it's censorship resistant. The internet goes back to the way that it was meant to be. And the reason that I'm so bullish on this is because we're seeing the smartest minds, they're leaving Facebook. They're leaving these big corporations where they could be getting $1 million paycheck. And we now have estimates between 100,000 and, you know, 500,000 of these developers around the world that are building decentralized applications, working on Ethereum, the majority of them are. There's also a lot of smart people working on Bitcoin and these other projects. But you're betting against innovation and you're betting against the smartest people in the world. And they're going to solve these problems, I think. It's just a matter of if it takes, you know, 1 year or 5 years.
All right. That's fantastic. I appreciate you walking me through that.
No, I think even if you don't invest in Bitcoin, I think you should still just download the app and buy $10 and, you know, send your friend.
How do I download the app? I don't even know how to do that, man. How do I, what app do I download?
So there's a number of exchanges. So like, you're in America, yeah?
Right now I'm in Colombia.
Okay. So Coinbase is probably one of the most widely used in the world, where you just download the app. It'll say, link your bank account, verify your ID. And once that's linked, you can just buy some Bitcoin and you'll have it in an address. And then there'll be a button that says send, and you can send it to my address. And addresses are just like a BSB account number.
But who has that key? Like, how do I?
In that instance, most people start when they buy their first Bitcoin, the exchange has your keys and they're sort of keeping it on their website. Once you've bought it, if you're educated on how to do so, that's when you send it to your own thumb drive or your own computer or whatnot.
Okay, so, let me think this through. So you don't get a new key for each Bitcoin. You have a personal key, and that allows you to access all of the Bitcoin that are on the blockchain in your name, or in the name of your key, I guess.
It's very similar to online banking, where you have a BSB and account number and you have a password where you log into your online banking. In the Bitcoin world, we have an address, which is just like your BSB and account number. We can say to people, send Bitcoins to my address. And you have a key where you can log in and send those Bitcoins, and you secure them and you keep that securely. So you can have one Bitcoin in there, you can have 100, but you just need that key because you're securing your BSB and account number.
Right, but can you get a new key in the future, or once you have a key, that's your key for life?
You can. I've got hundreds of keys. I've got one on my phone, one on my computer. Okay. You can have as many or as few as you like, yeah.
Okay, so that was my concern. So if Coinbase has your one key and you want to stop using Coinbase because now you've got 100 grand in Bitcoin and you just don't really trust the counterparty risk, you can create another key exclusively for your thumb drive that Coinbase doesn't have.
Yes, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I get it. That's really cool. I do see it as a great speculation. It's I'm going to have to do it, but I think that's a good idea to go ahead and just do like $100 or $1,000, something like that, just to play around with it and get an idea of how it works. And then once you become comfortable with it, then maybe go ahead and taking the plunge.
Do you have your phone on you now?
Yeah.
Do you want to download an app called Living Room of Satoshi?
Is it just on the App Store?
Yeah, actually, Wallet of Satoshi. And you're gonna be the first person that uses the Lightning Network before you've used the Bitcoin Network. How about that?
Very cool. So let's see. So Wallet of Satoshi.
Yeah.
So it's this one, right?
Yep, that's the one. Once it's installed, up the top there should just be a button that says receive. And you can edit this in as well if you like. We're going to show you how to use the Lightning Network.
Sure, very cool. Okay, welcome to the world's simplest Lightning wallet. Happy Bitcoining. Read disclosure document. Okay, start. So Satoshi's zero. Okay, so.
Top right hand corner, can you click on receive?
Yeah. Receive. Okay, so I've got this this thing.
If you hold that up to the camera, See if it can focus. Perfect. So
this is what I would, if I went to the Starbucks or whatever, I'd just give them this thing, and that's what they'd run the transaction off of?
Yeah, you can either do it with Bitcoin or Lightning Network, but you're just scanning QR codes, which are a little bit like your address or your BSB account number, but instead of numbers, it's just in a code format.
I see it. You can go to either Bitcoin or Lightning Network there, right?
Yeah, and you can scan. So what I did just then was just scanned that QR code that you put up to the screen on my phone. And if you watch the screen, I'll click on send 10,000 Satoshis, which is $1. So I'll click on send, pay, and that should say confirmed. So that's anywhere in the world you can send people Bitcoin. So that's pretty cool.
That is extremely cool. So what's my key?
So this wallet is a little... So this is, again, it's an example of one where the app maker has the key. So this is why we only have small amounts of money in there.
So this is like Coinbase. Okay, got it. Okay, I've got a caution sign here. Log in to back up. Okay, so I haven't logged in yet. So I've got to maybe give them my email address and stuff to back it up, I'm assuming. But anyway, my point is, if I had, let's say I get to the point where I'm not comfortable having the amount that I've got in here, how would I transfer this onto my thumb drive and then create a new key so I don't have this counterparty risk anymore?
So you need to, you'd buy like a thumb drive, like a Ledger hardware wallet. And then you'd open that up and install the Bitcoin app, and then it'll say generate a new address, and that's your address, and the key will live on the thumb drive. And then you would use that app and click on send or scan and send your Bitcoins to the new address that you create on your thumb drive. But the Lightning Network, it's a little bit like having cash in your wallet. So this is just play money. You don't really need to worry about backing up a dollar. It's more just something where we have a bit of play money we can send around.
So the Lightning Network, it works a lot faster, but it has less privacy because it's kind of sacrificing one for the other. So I'm thinking this through. If I had, let's say, 100,000 in Bitcoin on my thumb drive, but I was going to visit you in Australia for a week, and I wanted to use some Bitcoin, I thought, well, I only want to take, let's say, $3,000 with me. Then I could transfer $3,000 from my thumb drive to my Satoshi wallet and then use the Lightning Network in order to just pay for transactions a lot faster than having to use it on the blockchain. Am I seeing it correct?
That's right. But it's actually extremely private. So nobody knows that you and I just did that. That's just between you and I. So it's more private than Bitcoin.
This is more private than Bitcoin. Or it's more anonymous.
Yeah, only you and I know what just happened then around the world. No one else can trace that or anything.
Okay, so what is the downside to the Lightning Network?
The downside is that at the moment, the app or the exchange or the website manages our keys, and that we can only use small amounts. So I wouldn't even put $1,000 in there. It's like cash in your wallet. Keep a couple of $100 max. If you're going on holidays, you can download like another crypto wallet, for example, and you can have that on your phone, and you can pair that app with your laptop, and you can pair that with your computer at home. So if you lose one or two of them while you're on holidays, it's all paired and backed up to your computer back at home. Put your $3,000 on holiday. You can spend some Bitcoin. You can send some to the Lightning Network if you want to spend it that way. There's so many apps now. Like, you've got dozens to choose from that all do things differently, but they're all very easy to use these days. It's just a matter of getting education out there. Like, that's the only thing that's stopping Bitcoin adoption.
Yeah, that's really cool, man. I just had no idea that you could do that, Alex.
A lot of the guys I have on the channel aren't crypto believers. So I have on economists and gold guys, and I always try and send them some Bitcoin over Lightning like we just did then. And they're normally like, oh, wow, okay. Like, and they start to think about the implications of being able to send people money instantly anywhere in the world. And
yes, that's exactly what I'm doing right now, because I spend so much time out of the United States and I've been to so many different countries. I understand exactly what you're saying about how hard it is. It's not, I wouldn't say hard, it's just labor intensive to get money from the United States here in Colombia, as an example, just to buy an apartment, or just if you want to send down 10 grand for spending money, you just paperwork, you got to set up a brokerage account and this and that and that and that. And then of course you take a 4% haircut. If you're going through a bank, and it's just so cumbersome. And I always wondered, you know, why this is crazy. All the money is anyway, is just an electronic digit. It's just right. It's like a scoreboard. So why is it so difficult to get an electronic number just to reflect in my bank account in Colombia what it reflects in the United States with just a simple math conversion based on the exchange rate?
And then the banks come out and announce record profits because they've been charging us $50 to push that enter on the keyboard.
Yeah, and you know, going back to negative interest rates, it's going to get a lot worse because, as you know, retail banking is completely unprofitable when you have a flat yield curve, let alone an inverted yield curve. And so if they can't get the rates in the long end up, the retail is, they're completely done. So the less money they can make, obviously they're going to try to survive. And I think that their survival mode is going to be just nickel and diming the average guy, whether it's an overdraft fee or wire fees, or you're going to see banks going back to, I guess, I don't want to say how they were originally because they're a lot better, but you're going to see banks going back to the business of charging the customers in order for the customers to lend the banks their money in the first place to use as reserves or however hell they're going to use it.
I'm not sure if you've seen what's going on in Australia, but there's this real rush to phase out cash. And there was a Senate hearing recently, and all the witnesses just, like, they couldn't explain why they were doing it. And the senators were kind of like, it doesn't make sense why you're trying to ban cash, because they won't admit that there's negative interest rates coming.
Who was they? Who's they trying to do it?
So they had people from obviously the banks saying about how much that this is needed. And then they had the people saying that, oh, you know, there's all this tax evasion and criminals using cash, but there's no evidence to support that at all. They had people from like the Uniting Church come in and say how bad cash is. And they were like, why does a church care about cash? But they're paid off by the auditors, and all the auditors are going to make way more money if everyone has to use cash. And so there's this big, you know, this insider circle of people trying to phase out cash in Australia before we go down the path of negative interest rates.
Yeah. And it's under the veil of increased security, like it always is. But once you pull back the kimono, you see that it's actually just lobbyists and special interest groups trying to do this in order to gain more control or make more money. But isn't it I'm surprised that it's not the politicians and the central bankers from the standpoint of negative interest rates. And these Keynesians, just, you know, as well as I do, they've got one tool. That's a hammer. And that hammer is money printing and negative or low interest rates. So whenever you have a problem, no matter what it is, the cure is always lower interest rates and money printing. So I'm surprised that the politicians and the central bankers aren't the ones that are really, really pushing that no cash anymore. So then they have the power to take it -5, -10, whatever they want.
I think they received a lot of pushback. Like, a few videos that we made and others made really got traction. And there was a number of people calling their representatives and saying, you know, there's going to be protests if you ban cash. And so I think they're really feeling the pressure.
Oh, so then that they started to back off.
Mm.
Well, I hope that that's a great thing about the internet. I hope that people really keep it up and keep producing this type of content, so the average Joe out there isn't lulled to sleep and isn't brainwashed by the politicians and the central banks to assume that this is, meaning banning cash, is beneficial for them because of security, or, you know, just because we can track down more people who are trying to evade taxes. Or that's the problem with the people on the left, is they really fall victim to this type of narrative, this propaganda, because they're so sympathetic to, you know, taking taxes to pay for Medicare for All, or what we have in the States, or any of those political agendas, that they can be manipulated to, I don't want to say the useful idiot, but that's kind of what it is. It's just really, really unfortunate. I did a video the other day just on TSA, and I'm sure you guys have something the equivalent down in Australia. I actually lived in the Gold Coast.
What's the TSA?
The TSA is just the airport security that the government has. Back before 9/11 in the United States, the majority of the airport security was private. It was done by the airlines. But then when we had the, ironically called the Patriot Act, come in, and then you have this TSA, and initially it's sold as, well, it's for your security. And people, you know, after such a tragic event, they're all gung-ho. Yeah, more TSA. Yeah, more security, more security. And what ends up happening is it costs billions and billions of dollars. It reduces the privacy and the individual liberty of the citizens themselves, and it doesn't make you any more secure. In the video I did the other day, I used an example, and this was a true story. I was in Brooklyn in 2012, and I was at a flea market with a gal I was dating, and I bought a necklace that's got a rifle shell on it that's literally this big. I mean, I don't know what type of rifle, but it's the size of my pinky. It's huge. And I bought it, forgot all about it, put it at the bottom of my toiletries bag. Fast forward 3 or 4 years, I've flown all over the country, taken hundreds of flights in and outside of the United States. And of those, let's say 300 flights, you know, how many times did my water get taken? Did my toothpaste get taken? My cuticle scissors, my tweezers, my chapstick? I mean, all these things that are totally ridiculous. But how many times did TSA find my bullet that's this big in the bottom of my bag? Zero times. Zero. Yeah. They never found it. And that's after hundreds and hundreds of flights. So anyone that has the argument that, yeah, I get it, it's reducing security, but it is a cost-benefit analysis, but I think that the benefits far outweigh the costs. They're buying into the intentions of the law instead of the reality of the law. And as you and I both know, that the intentions of what politicians do, the actual reality is most often the complete opposite of that.
Exactly, man. Yeah.
How can people find you, Alex? I know you're with your website, and your company is Nuggets News, and you're obviously a pro in this. So you do consulting, and I think you have a membership group. How can we find out more about what you do and learn a lot more about this technology that is just super cool?
Yeah, so we love to give people the best nuggets of information, I guess. So 90% of what we do is free on YouTube and Facebook and Twitter, if you just look up Nuggets News or Alex Saunders. And then we do have a premium group where you get extra content, access to reports on our favorite cryptocurrencies, some updates on gold and silver, a bit of everything. And that's $50 Australian a month. So that's been really popular with our investors that have been with us for a few years now. And we're really excited for the next wave coming out of what I think is the end of the bear market in cryptocurrency.
All right. So if any of you out there are interested in learning more about crypto, like I am, whether you're a gold guy or a Bitcoin guy or gal, it doesn't matter. This is just stuff that's really fun to learn about and just take your education to the next level. So, Alex, I really appreciate your time. Thanks for being on the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Love it. Thanks, George. Good luck with it all. Cheers.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com. Or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.